And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 16th, 2020. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I'm excited to be talking about ranked choice voting today. We've got Nate Lockwood joining us, and he'll tell us what it is and why it matters.
So, Mariah, do you ever remember a circumstance where the election was really close and maybe there was a third party candidate and like nobody got more than 50% of the vote and everyone was in angst and wound up? I don't know. When did that happen recently?
I don't know. I can't imagine.
I mean, it's not current. It's not on our consciousness at all. Well, anyway, there's this phenomena where if they're in America, I think, America, we describe our voting system as essentially a winner take all. Each vote, whoever gets the most votes wins. So if you have multiple people in a contest, sometimes you can end up with a voting result where nobody gets 50% of the vote, but still the leading person is declared the winner because that's how we roll in the United States. There are lots of other ideas about how you could express your preference in voting. One of those is called ranked choice voting. And in there, the idea is basically when you go into the polling booth, you say, I like candidate A, candidate Smith. He's first choice. Candidate Jones, she's my second choice. And basically that all gets put in a blender and the highest preference person comes out the other end and wins. And that, for various reasons, is kind of a climate issue. So what we did was to reach out to a volunteer for the here in Massachusetts for the ranked choice voting ballot question. So here in Massachusetts, it's on the ballot in this upcoming election, whether or not to use this kind of ranked choice voting. And we're pleased to have with us Nate Lockwood, who's a volunteer with the Yes on Two campaign here in Massachusetts. How you doing, Nate?
Hey, I'm doing great, Ted.
Good. So, Nate, I just wandered all over the metaphorical lot talking about ranked choice voting. Can you tell me what is the nub and crux of ranked choice voting? Why should people care about it? And why should they vote for it here in Massachusetts if it's on the ballot?
Yeah, well, so ranked choice voting is really just one simple change that's being proposed for Massachusetts elections. And it's being proposed in order to give voters more choices when they go to vote and a more powerful ballot and to ensure fair outcomes so that whenever we vote, we can feel confident that the winner has the support of the broadest majority of voters. So unlike recent elections we've seen, important elections like the one in Congressional District 4 recently and in 2018 in Congressional District 3, where we were electing people to U.S. Congress, and the winners got only 22%. Ranked choice voting ensures that the candidate who wins has the support of a majority. And
can we just roll through so I have personal experience with the Massachusetts 4th district race. That was a primary, right? A primary race where there were, I think, 8 or 9 candidates, right? The exact number doesn't matter. 8 or 9 candidates. From my perspective, several were progressive candidates who splintered a progressive vote, and the ultimate winner ended up winning by getting something like 20% of the vote, right? So this is a primary, not a primary election, as an example, but that's a specific case where this. So how would the ranked choice voting have worked there in the MAO4 race?
Right. So the difference in the voter's experience would be, as you went to vote in that race, Ted, you had to decide which one of those 9 candidates were you going to support with your vote. And then we just counted the votes up, and whoever got the most of those would win. And as you said, it turned out to be 24%. With ranked choice, you would have been able to say, well, this one is my first choice, but if they don't have the support to win, this one's my second choice, and by the way, thanks for asking. This one's my third choice, my fourth choice, my fifth choice. And you could rank as many or as few as you liked. If you only liked one, you could just rank one. So as a voter, you would get to more fully express how you felt about that field if you wished to. And along with the way of marking the ballots, the only other part of the change is how we count those ballots. The way we count ranked choice ballots is very similar to the way we count them now. Everybody still only has one vote, but they use an instant runoff mechanism to count. So it's like having a series of runoff elections, but instead of having to go out to the polls on different days and get time off of work and get people to watch your kids, you just fill out your ballot. And because you told us who your favorite was and who your next choice was and your choice after that, we can do the runoff election without dragging you out to the polls again. So the way those ballots are counted is we just look at everybody's first choice and we see, did anybody get a majority in the election? And so if everybody's first choice was the same as what they picked in CD4, we'd look at them and we'd say, well, you know what? Of these nine candidates, none of them got a majority. We see Jake got 23 or 24 and Jesse Mermel got, 22 or 23.
Those are the candidates in the race, yeah.
But nobody got a majority. So with ranked choice, instead of saying, well, even though 75% voted for somebody else, we're going to make this person the winner, we say, this isn't good enough yet. We'd like to know who a majority of these voters preferred in this race. So we would look at the candidates that had the least support, and we would look at their ballots, and we'd, sort of say, thank you for running. This was really great that you participated. We're now going to look at the ballots of the people who supported you and give them an opportunity for their one vote to count towards their next choice. And so
would you say, just to be so I understand it, you're saying that everybody votes for first choice, second choice, third choice. If there is nobody gets above 50%, then you look at all the ballots and say the candidate who got the fewest first choice numbers gets basically taken out of the mix. And
exactly.
For that candidate, all of the second choices get then reapportioned to the other candidates. And then you ask if you've got to 50%, right? And
exactly.
That process keeps going.
Exactly. And you repeat that eliminating another candidate, another least supported candidate, until you find the one that it has a majority, and eventually you will.
Uh-huh.
And so what's nice about that is, let's say you had described a situation where you felt like the winner was significantly different than the next five candidates running up to them. Let's say that is true. People like you who voted for one of the other five candidates, they might have picked, let's say your first choice was Ihsan Leki, or your first choice was Rebecca Grossman, but you said, I'd be pretty happy with Jesse Mermel too, or Natalie Linos, or you could rank them, and if your first choice had the least support, then your vote would now count towards the next. The effect of that is, if you got a bunch of people who basically like that group of candidates, Their vote counts. That's going to get, instead of getting divided between and weakening all those candidates, it's going to get consolidated into a block, and it's going to get consolidated behind the candidate in that group that has similar positions that has the most support. So it has this sort of effect of consolidating the votes of like-minded voters even when there's lots of candidates, mm-hmm. instead of having lots of candidates running, sort of fragmenting that group of like-minded voters.
And so what's the advantage? So tell me the advantage. So that's the process, right, Mariah? I mean, that's the process,
right?
we've got.
I mean, how does it apply to climate change? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I guess, what are the advantages and disadvantages of that process? Right. So, I think it seems pretty clear that you do not end up with a candidate who got a minority of the votes. The major advantage, you would say, is that the result of the election expresses the wish of most of the people.
Exactly. And I think, for climate supporters, I think, I'd ask you folks, how do you feel that, preventing climate change is an issue that has appeal amongst the majority of the voters? And, or, you know, or could, do you think that it's an issue that a group of the majority of the voters could be persuaded about, I guess? And that's an interesting thing. You know, another thing I say is an issue which, you know, I think climate, it polls very strongly amongst voters. But even let's say it didn't. The nice thing about ranked choice is by right now, you know, we're looking at this example in CD4 where there was a large field. So there's lots of choices for Democratic primary voters. But really the problem was figuring out which one to vote for as a voter. How do I know how to make my vote count? Like, am I wasting my vote voting for my favorite? And then the other issue is the problem is most visible in the outcome where, you know, the candidate with the least wins. There's other cases where someone will not run because they don't want to hurt a similar candidate, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's tough because what ends up happening in the general elections is usually we only have, you know, two choices that we can vote for confidently without just worrying about wasting our vote. And other good candidates just don't run because they don't want to be blamed for ruining it for, you know, their side or whatnot.
I guess that's the other major thing is it allows third party votes to be viable. And right, Mariah, what's your take on it?
You know, so I think that in a ranked choice system, ranked choice voting system, you have the opportunity to say, I really like this candidate without then giving your vote to someone who may be completely opposite from what you are. Because you can say, I really like this candidate. Say you have a candidate who's very, very strong on climate policy. So they're your number one choice. And then you have a candidate whose platform is okay on climate policy. And then you have a candidate whose platform is very bad on climate policy, right? So you can vote number one, the one who's got the strong platform on climate policy, number two, the one who's, you know, okay on climate policy. And even if that number one candidate is not part of one of the major parties systems in the country, you're not completely eroding that party system by voting for that number one candidate. And it basically allows you to show your support for what their platform is without destroying the other, the campaign of your second favorite.
I mean, I could put specific names on that, right? If you take Jay Inslee, right, who was running in the presidential primary, you kind of knew that he was not going to make it all the way through, but you really appreciated his platform, right? He could be your first vote, and then you could pick one of the others as a second, you know, and you would not be, as you say, right, throwing away your vote, right? And especially if you think of a general election case, I mean, if you rolled back to Bush v. Gore, the people who voted for, what's his name?
Nader.
I was going to say Joe Naismith, but I don't know.
Or Jill Stein in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, the people who voted for those things, you could vote for them and still have a second choice as Gore, and we wouldn't have ended up in the ugly situation we were in. Right?
Yeah. I know that, you know, Bill McKibben talked in an article in The New Yorker that Nate shared with us, a great article that sort of talks about some of these issues, how, you know, having a Green Party in other countries works because there's, you know, there's not it's not a two-party system, right? You have four parties in many, many countries. And so that allows you to, you know, have a diverse array of sort of approaches, you know, what they call it, not the working party, but the Labor Party and the Green Party and so on and so forth. But in our two-party system right now, the way it stands, if you vote for one of the sort of minority parties, you basically aren't voting in some ways, or, you know, it does just kind of, it's blue on black to a certain degree. So this would allow those parties to maybe even start to rise a little bit more, right? If you have, it allows people to put their support toward them without sacrificing the bigger picture, which then gives them a little more traction.
I mean, that seems to me literally the thin edge of the wedge, Mariah, right? I mean, it's like you get to vote for the person that really passionately you agree with without compromising your greater, you know, desire that that your side wins. And yeah, that's a way to introduce other voices. And I think, Nate, tell me, some of the articles that you sent through were very informative. They talked about how the ranked choice voting supports or allows women in particular, women of color, people of color, to to basically have more success in the voting process, right? Is that, I mean, is that a fair to be elected more? Because I guess, you know, the more marginalized voices are allowed more credibility in a ranked choice voting circumstance.
Yeah. So that there is some data which does support that it helps, women and people of color both run for office and win. A lot of this data, some of the studies come from the San Francisco Bay Area, which was kind of a relatively early adopter of the cities that have sort of adopted ranked choice voting in the U.S. RCV is used now in like over half the U.S. states in some form. And now, you know, probably well north of, you know, close to 20 cities now. It keeps growing every year. Mm-hmm. In terms of have been using it, probably about 15, and then a few, many have adopted in the last couple of years. But the data from San Francisco is that, since adopting ranked choice voting, women of color in particular, people of color generally, and to a smaller extent, women in general, have experienced higher rates of election to office. I think in Oakland, for example, since Oakland adopted ranked choice voting, people of color have won like 50% more seats than they were winning previous to ranked choice voting. Now, some of this when you talk about we adopted ranked choice voting and before and after, I mean, there's other things going on, right, culturally, right. Evolution there. It appear to certainly not be hurting. And when compared with other kind of control group cities, it's a higher growth in success than there.
Well, so to maintain intellectual honesty, I have to ask you,
sure,
what's the argument against it? I remember teachers telling me that if you couldn't say what your opponent's arguments were, you didn't understand your own, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, what's the complaint about ranked choice voting? Why would we not all do it?
The biggest complaint, I believe, the opponents of ranked choice voting are saying is that it confuses voters and that that some voters are penalized more than others by having to rank choices. So that's the argument against, is that some groups of voters will not be able to do this as well as other groups of voters. And it's hard for voters in general to do.
In other words, to know enough about all the candidates to have sort of a gradation of opinion about each.
Yeah, that's one flavor of it. Yeah, to understand the concept of ranking, to have information about groups of candidates. Now, the polling that's been done in the places that have adopted ranked choice voting show very high levels of voter understanding, very high levels of voters using the rankings to express their ballots more completely. And exit polls that have been done in many cities, they always show greater than 50% favorability. And typically it's, in 60 and 70% of voters who prefer ranked choice voting over the way they had voted previously. So it's a really satisfying change is what's being found in the places that adopt it. I think just intuitively too, I don't know anyone over the age of 4, and even many people 4 and under, we rank things every day. It's like, I'm going to the corner store. I'm going to get you some candy. Do you want a Yeah, exactly. Lollipop, candy bar.
I think that it's kind of a civic education thing, right? I mean, if there's any confusion about it at all, that's, why we pay our taxes, to make sure everyone understands how to operate in a voting booth, right? Because it's confusing enough as it is now, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another interesting point that I have read about it is that it creates a more civil, election process. You're less likely to slander when you are hoping that, somebody might vote for this candidate and then put you as the next choice, right? So it actually makes everyone's voting, everyone's electioneering, they're running their campaign a little bit friendlier to all candidates. And I think that's a nice upside.
Yeah. I have met relatively few people that like negative campaigning, right? So candidates still need to distinguish themselves, because you want to get as many votes as possible, but yes, you also want to earn wherever possible, the votes of your opponent's supporters. Because, you know, as they start consolidating the votes, that may be what puts you over the top. So in that effect that you're describing of the more civil campaigning has actually been measured in studies based on surveys in cities that were using ranked choice voting and cities that weren't using ranked choice voting. And they found, they asked questions like, you know, the candidates made negative attacks on each other often, right? And mm-hmm. so the response rates were different in the RCV versus the non-RCV cities. So, yeah, I think in more broadly, so in addition to more civil, less, you know, gratuitous negative attacks, I think to me it's cool that there's an incentive to find areas. I sometimes feel like when I'm watching debates, whether it's the primaries or the general elections, that they could, you know, when you have two people running against each other in our current system and you throw an issue out there, it's hard to get, they almost are looking for reasons to disagree with each other. You know, you could say
they have to differentiate as opposed to saying, oh yeah, we both agree that, you know, let's you could vote for either of us on this point, right?
Exactly. So it would be nice if they could just, you know, when there's common sense areas that, you know, shared opinions, people could just say, you know what? My opponent thinks that's a good idea. I think that's a good idea. You elect either one of us, we're going to take care of that. You know, that'd be nice for climate change. That'd be nice for a lot of things.
I've heard of candidates that will actually say, okay, put me as the number one and then put this person as the number two, right? Some of them will actually sort of promote, hey, if I don't make it in, I share a lot of viewpoints with this candidate. So make sure you've got them as the second, which is an interesting strategy.
It is. And some people like that strategy and some people are not so crazy about it. And it sometimes is more over the top and sometimes more subtle. I think there's an election going on right now that probably a lot of folks have heard about in Maine, where they adopted ranked choice voting, first U.S. state to adopt it for state and federal elections in 2018. And it's pretty exciting. Susan Collins is defending her Senate seat from a challenge from Sarah Gideon, a Democrat and former state senator in Maine. And there's also a Green Party candidate, Lisa Savage, running. And there's also an independent candidate running whose name escapes me at the moment. But Lisa Savage, the Green Party candidate, she's participating in televised Senate debates, which is pretty exciting. She's getting her message out about, you know, the environment and climate. And she is running. She is saying, you know, vote for me first and vote for Sarah Gideon second.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the one that I'd heard about.
So tell me, Nate, what's the circumstance here in Massachusetts? This is on the ballot in Massachusetts, right? We're heading into in a few weeks, or maybe if you've already got your ballot. I mean, people can act on this now, right? What's the circumstance there, and what should people be thinking about?
Yeah. Thanks, Ted. So we have an incredible opportunity in Massachusetts to make a simple but very powerful change to our election system by voting yes on question two for ranked choice voting. If you're voting by mail, it's on your ballot. If you're going to vote in person, it'll be on your ballot when you go in there. And a yes vote would adopt ranked choice voting for all state and federal elections held in Massachusetts, except for voting for the presidency. But any other office, governor, federal Senate, and so
would it do local elections as well, or is just statewide and office holders?
So question two only affects state and federal office holders. There is a bill in the Massachusetts legislature that would, if passed, would give municipalities an option to adopt ranked choice voting for their local elections. That's not, I don't know that that's in committee, I believe.
Yeah, that's a different, but I mean, if you had your senator, your representative, and all the state elections that with the ranked choice, I bet everyone else would soon follow. So that's sort of a inevitable. So tell me, where should people go if they want to learn more about ranked choice voting? What's the website?
Yeah, absolutely. The website is, let me grab that here. It's yesonnumber2, so yesontworcv.com. And you can learn more. There's an FAQ. It describes the ballot question detail. It describes ranked choice voting. It also talks about some of the people who support ranked choice voting, mm-hmm. which includes some climate organizations like Boston Sunrise, the Sierra Club, the Green Party, and 350.org Massachusetts.
Super. Good, good. All right. So yes on to rcv.org. Right.
Yes. And I encourage folks to, you know, there's if they are excited about it, they can go to that website and they can sign up for phone banks. Tomorrow is going to be hosted by Maura Healy, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And it's just really important that supporters of this spread the word and answer you learn about it so they can answer questions for their friends, because it's really this issue. Once people use it and learn about it, they love it at the rate of like 70%+. But it's really just the problem. The thing we're up against is education, really. A lot of people just haven't heard about it. And changing a voting system without understanding it, the change, is really a tough thing to ask people to do.
Yeah, good. Well, I hope that you have, well, I don't hope, I know that you've done a good job of helping us understand the issue much better. And so I want to thank you very much for coming. What we'll do is we'll put up links at the blog. So you can read more about this stuff. We'll put up the links to Yes on to RCV, the blog's at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you want, you can send an email to us at podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what you think of the show, what we ought to be talking about. Of course, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using any of the modern podcast distribution apps, and I'd ask you to please rank us and tell all your friends to listen to us on their modern podcast distribution app. You can find us by searching for Climate Minute, usually associated with the Mass Climate Action keywords. I want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support to keep us in, well, more than in, overwhelmed with interesting topics. Thanks so much, DR. We want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of those three things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Nate, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, it was my pleasure, Ted and Mariah. Really great to speak with you.
And Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to everyone for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Very cool.